Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ed Williams. In New Mexico and across the West, economies are changing fast. Farming and ranching communities and small towns are vanishing. Oil and gas booms and busts have hit the state's economy hard. Young people are leaving New Mexico to find better work opportunities. That's not true everywhere, though. Some communities are thriving and finding creative ways to adapt to the economic changes they're facing. KUNM has partnered with 9 other newsrooms in New Mexico to report on how rural communities are working to survive economically and what has been successful as part of the Solution Journalism Network's State of Change Project. What are people in your area doing to create jobs and grow the economy? Is it working? What can New Mexico learn from other states? Our phone lines are open this morning at 277-KUNM. That's 505-277-5866. Or send your thoughts by email to letstalk@kunm.org. Joining us in the studio this morning are KUNM reporter Marisa DeMarco and Leah Todd, reporter for Solutions Journalism. And Leah, your inaugural story for this project looked at the challenges small towns are facing as more people move to cities and economies seem to be concentrating in urban areas. What are some of the big economic trends here, and how are they impacting rural parts of the West?
Thanks, Ed. I think what we're seeing across the West right now is the loss of what used to be traditional rural jobs in farming, in ranching, in mining, and in some cases timber. And those jobs are not as economically viable as they were in the generation before us. And that has a lot of impacts on a state level for state budgets when income is typically derived from extractive mineral taxes and things like that. And it also has a lot of impacts for individual communities when a traditional historical major employer leaves. That sort of major exodus of an employer can have a bigger effect in a small town where there aren't other jobs that can come in and fill that gap than in a bigger city. So that's what we're seeing across the West. And there's some ways that New Mexico fits that trend. And there's one way that New Mexico stands out and doesn't fit the trend that we're seeing in the rest of the West. So this whole project took a look at individual New Mexico communities and tried to figure out what was standing out in terms of evidence of measurable progress against some aspect of this bigger economic problem. And one element that stood out to me in my reporting is that New Mexico statewide has actually created farming jobs over the last generation, when in reality, nationwide and definitely in the West overall, those jobs have been decimated. So that's an interesting way that New Mexico is already bucking this trend and could be, you know, an example or case study for the rest of the West.
Yeah, I definitely want to get back to this question of farming and agriculture. I mean, it's interesting because we think a lot about these changing economies in terms of, you know, coal mining shriveling up in West Virginia, steel mills closing in Pittsburgh, you know, Detroit automakers closing down, and all these kind of struggles with identity that go along with that, not just losing jobs, but losing like, hey, this is who I am, now right. What, right? But we don't have steel mills, we don't have car factories, we don't have coal mines for the most part. So what are these changes? Can you talk a little bit more about what actually these shifts are?
Yeah, so here? In the inaugural story that I wrote that you mentioned in your intro, Ed, I looked at the community of Cuesta, which had a molybdenum mine for the past nearly century that employed most of that community. And in 2014, that mine shut down and about 300 people were laid off. And now there are still some jobs that are associated with cleaning up the mine, but it's decimated the traditional economic bedrock of the community. And there's this real question of where are the jobs going to come from in the next generation in Cuesta. The community of Mora in northern New Mexico was another community that I looked at that was historically agriculturally based, and population there has been shrinking since the 70s. You know, where are the people going to come from to keep Mora alive 50 years from now? Now, that community is interesting because, like New Mexico overall, they have, despite declining population, managed to also create agricultural jobs over that same time frame. So, again, an interesting kind of case study for what's going on there. It would be interesting to take a closer look.
But in, for the most part, these populations are shrinking or at best remaining stagnant. And I mean, it does seem like cities are the inevitable future, right? I mean, everywhere, including here, people are moving from small towns to bigger cities. There's more opportunity there. There's more investment. There's, a lot of young people would say there's just more going on. So why is it important to save these small towns? Why should we care?
I think that's an open question. I mean, it will be a different answer for a different person in each community. I think there are a lot of cultural reasons. I mean, the list is long in terms of cultural reasons why small towns are valuable. And I mean, it's where many of our families came from. It's where most of the tribal communities in this state are located. You know, ancestral and tree lands are all in rural places mostly today. And so there's a lot of arguments, kind of culturally speaking, which I think are important for why these small towns need to be saved. The real question is economically, is there a real role for small rural communities in the West to play today beyond as sort of refugee places for, you know, stressed city residents who want to come and take
second
a vacation.
Homes and, yeah.
Right. Second home areas or tourist traps. And that's a question that, you know, we can talk about all day long. But really, it's up, I think, to each community to decide what will its reasons for existing be, and to the next generation, what will our identity be?
I think as you're talking about it, too, it occurs to me that, you know, obviously not all small towns are the same, and some have very, very long histories of existence, and some came about because people put a mine there or put some kind of extractive industry there. And so that could play a role in which ones continue to exist and which ones, you know, change or shift or, you know, dwindle.
Right. And we're talking about what is going to be the role of these small towns in the future. What place do they have in the larger economy? And Leah, you did find that places like Mora, what, has doubled its agricultural jobs? Is that the right figure I was reading in your story? That's pretty amazing. How are they doing that? What is this model that they've been working with?
The one clue that I have there is from a former county commissioner who now is a hunting and guiding guide, I guess. So he runs his own outfitting company. And he has been involved in creating a series of cooperatives in Mora. They're on their third now. The first was a cooperative for the traditional ranching community there. The second was a cooperative for local growers. And the third that they're trying to create now is for we'll call it the timber industry, which is basically the long tradition of families cutting their own firewood and selling it or just using it for their own consumption to heat their homes. And these cooperatives were the only thing that I could put my finger on that could be behind that growth in agricultural jobs.
Where are they selling their products?
That's a good question. For the agricultural co-op, I know sell at SIDS up in Taos, where I live.
Okay.
And then they sell around the area. So it's basically local growers on the ground saying, let's pool our resources together. Let's hire some people to do really good marketing for us and create markets for our products that we couldn't find potentially on our own. That's the idea behind the concept.
Mm-hmm. And Marisa, you've been out reporting on the Navajo Nation recently, and I know there used to be a big agricultural tradition, at least on the Navajo Nation, even if it was small scale. There's also been, you know, a lot of mining, extractive businesses there. How have the economic realities been evolving on the reservation over the past few decades?
Yeah, so I talked to Jessica Stego of the Native American Business Incubator and Network, who said that basically 30 or 40 years ago, a whole wave of jobs, a flood of jobs came in with oil and gas and mining industries. And then, you know, now that those industries are volatile, they're unstable and unsure, and people are losing work. And the future can be really uncertain in those industries. So what she's working on is trying to bolster small businesses on the Navajo Nation with the idea that this could stabilize the economy. That's what her organization is working on. So we also talked to a co-op, a farming co-op. Like you're saying, you know, folks have a tradition of growing and eating their own food and, you know, providing food for their own family that they grew themselves. And so we talked to a farm where about 30 families, maybe a little more, seasonally grow their food and then, you know, store it over the winter and eat it. And it's useful, too, because in these rural regions, grocery stores can be pretty far away. So there's a lot of travel and expense associated with making a trip to the store, right? So it's interesting because it kind of starts to move away from like a cash model, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, not entirely away from a cash model, but like if you're growing your own food and eating it, or if you're trading some of your food with some of your neighbors who have different produce, you know, then maybe some of the cash portion of the economy is not in play, you know?
So it sounds like you're talking about, I mean, not so much maybe economic growth, but like economic stability. I mean, the fact that we're just creating some kind of stability in terms of growing food, providing it for our neighbors and stuff, not necessarily exporting it and things like that.
Yeah. And like you're saying, like this is a long tradition in that area. And so when you're considering like which towns in which communities are going to continue to thrive, it probably is going to be communities that have like a long history of this other kind of economy and this other kind of self-sustaining process, right? So I think that's an interesting part of the conversation this morning.
And that makes me think, Marie, so when we talk about this question or idea of rural resiliency, that was a theme that the reporters behind this project threw around a lot. We really have to ask ourselves, well, what are we talking about when we say resilient? Do we mean growth in jobs? Do we mean growth in personal income? Do we mean growth in population? Or do we mean, as I quoted the former mayor of Cuesta in my story, that the people who have historically lived in this community can continue to do so? And I think there's a real argument to be made for any and maybe some combination of all of those definitions of resiliency. And there's this real question of, do communities need to grow? Or is there something to be said for Cuesta shrinking back to something like a more sustainable size, if we can think of it that way? I mean, jobs came into that community just like you said they did onto the Navajo Nation 30, 40 years ago. Jobs came into Cuesta 100 years ago. You know, the population grew. What is lost if that town continues to sustain its sort of minimum population, but just isn't as big as it once was? You know, is that an okay future or fate for that town? And it's not up to us, I guess I should say, to decide. It's just as journalists, we're exploring this question with people on the ground.
Sure. I think too that on the Navajo Nation, the conversation's a little bit different because that is their ancestral land and people want to live there. And that might be different than folks who are from a small town that they don't really have that deep of a connection to, and they don't feel an obligation to continue living there. And so it might change the conversation a little bit. I bet Marley can kind of speak a little bit more to that.
Yeah, I mean, Navajo Nation, any small towns across the state, you know, it seems like the common theme is unemployment. There's a lot of lack of jobs. And on the phone with us right now is Marley Shabala. Marley is an independent journalist who's been covering the Navajo Nation for many years and is based out there. Hi, Marley.
Oh, good morning. And I actually work for the Gallup Independent newspaper also.
Okay, great. So, Marley, you know, unemployment in the Navajo Nation is really, really high, right? I mean, 50% higher than the New Mexico rate. And New Mexico has one of the highest rates of anywhere. So what would you say is behind this high unemployment rate out on the reservation?
It's because the Navajo Nation government thought that a quick fix would be bringing in large industry and employing the people in you know, large amounts. And of course, yeah, you know, but the large industries aren't permanent and they go away. And so you just are left with salvaging our reclamation of the what they're leaving behind. Plus, a lot of these large industries, which were extractive industries, they've resulted in, I think a lot of people are aware of the abandoned uranium mines on the reservation, which has contaminated the water and also the land and the air, the people, the animals, the whole contamination of the food cycle. And so you end up spending a lot more money trying to correct what was supposed to be a great idea for employment. And then you take the people off and away from their natural way of or their sustainable life way. And so then you have this farmlands that are left. They're abandoned. And so they have to go back in and try to get the people back into farming and try to get that same type of employment on the same level as what they're receiving for maybe a coal mining job, which gave $50,000 a year, you know, so it's difficult.
Do those mining jobs that you're talking about tend to move people around? I mean, are people moving from one part of the reservation to another and kind of uprooting their, you know, their families, their lives in order to work at a job that then goes bust and then, you know, then what do they do?
No, they don't. I think that people don't understand the lifestyle of Navajo people, and this is just true for Indian country. We're our, this is our homeland. You know, America is our homeland, the USA. And so in the initial impact to us was that we were placed into a smaller area, each of the tribes. Mm-hmm. And so with that lifestyle, we have to have that land base, because we still have our ceremonies. And our ceremonies involve the building of huge fires. We build temporary outside structures, and we feed a lot of people, so we have to, we do our own butchering. And as I'm talking about that, maybe people are saying, you know, how can you sustain that kind of lifestyle in a city? I mean, they would demand that you have, you know, fire permission, fire permits, permits for animals, because we have to use horses, mm-hmm. permits for hauling water, because we have to haul huge amounts of water, because we feed a huge amount of people. And just temporary structures, and then you have to deal with the health board. And out here, but it, that's the way we lived, and we know how to live that lifestyle without you know, giving ourselves food poisoning. And so when I'm talking about the land base, that's very important. And so you have this, we've always had this attachment to the land and to what we call our home. Like, you, I'm originally from an area that's near Chaco Canyon, and my family has lived there since forever, since before the Europeans came. And a lot of the people, if you come up to them and say, where are you originally from, or where are you from, they will tell you, well, I live in Window Rock, or I'm going to school here at UNM, but my home is, you know, back at, you know, this little small town on the reservation. So you still keep that home base. And yes, you do move around, but a lot of people end up, because of the lack of housing also, the lack of infrastructure, because I think that people sometimes don't understand how employment goes hand in hand with building of the infrastructure itself.
Right. Well, Marley, I want to come back to that point after a break, but we do need to break here for 1 minute. We're talking about the changing economy and how rural New Mexico is coping. We'll be back in 1 minute.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Support comes from DaVita Medical Group, who believes everything matters. During this year's open enrollment period, there are choices when it comes to healthcare. More information on DaVita Medical Group at DaVitaMedGroupNM.com.
Pianist Andras Schiff says he begins every day by playing a full hour of music by Bach.
Because it's like taking care of your inner hygiene. There's something very pure about it.
Andras Schiff on the musical Breakfast of Champions. And we'll hear him in concert on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of Mexico, and we're back talking about the economic challenges rural New Mexico is facing, how communities are adapting and finding solutions. How is your town working to build jobs, and what do you think the economy will look like 10 years from now, 20 years from now? Call now. The number is 877-899-5866. That's 1-877-899-5866. You can also join the conversation on Twitter, where we're live tweeting the program, and we're using two hashtags this morning, Let's Talk NM and NM Resilience. And Marley Shabala is still on the phone with us. And Marley, right before the break, you were talking about infrastructure, and I want to ask you and Marisa, because you've both been covering this issue. I wonder, how do you actually get an economic development movement going in an area that's so rural, as not just the Navajo Nation, but tribal lands in general? How do you attract investment in high-speed internet, water, electricity, things that you need to build a business?
And Marley, do you want to tackle that?
Oh, yeah. I think that it's maybe not attracting the businesses itself, but working through the government itself, because they have access to the federal government. A lot of federal funding and grants come from that. And also here on the Navajo Nation, I went over and I spoke to the Division of Economic Development Director. Excuse me. Her name is Crystal Deschini. And she has looked at developing and understands that small businesses is the answer for building any kind of a rural community, that you can't bring in big industry and expect the community to survive because it's going to go. It's not going to be permanent. So the ones that are going to be permanent are the residents. And so how do you strengthen what they have always provided to live in their community? I mean, they're existing in these small communities, and how are they doing that? And why are they doing that? They have a loyalty to that home base, and they want it to continue to exist. They want to tell their children, this is where you come from. Oh, over there at that place, we had your birthday party, or come over here, this is where our ancestors lived, and this is where, you know, we placed them back into Mother Earth. And those kind of feelings and thinking is also what Indian Country very much believes in. And so Crystal Deschini is one I've been covering the Navajo Nation for over 30 years. And she's one of the first, I think, Division of Economic Development directors to really look at small businesses and say, and she told me this. I asked her, I said, do you think Wi-Fi plays an important role? Broadband in small businesses? She said, absolutely yes. And she says, and I understand you can't, the infrastructure is not there for Wi-Fi. Some places don't have electricity. There's no buildings to, you know, put up the laptops or businesses itself. And so she said, you know, what she's doing is offering what they have is these regional business development offices. And so small businesses can go there, set up their laptop, do their business, get exchanges also, be open for them to get their messages, and they can check in over there and then go back out to where they're at, where they might not get Wi-Fi. Like right now, I'm speaking to you as I'm sitting inside my car, outside my house, because this is the most reliable place to, you know, get Wi-Fi without all of a sudden, you know, I've dropped the call.
Yeah, and I talked to President Russell-Picque a couple weeks back, who said that the tribe recently took control of the telecommunication right-of-ways, which will enable the Navajo Nation to do the what's necessary to allow companies to build that internet infrastructure on the Navajo Nation.
But at the same time, there's these initiatives to boost small business, but there's also, you know, the tribal government's very much, you know, relying on oil and gas, extractive industry still, right? Marisa, in your story this morning, you pointed out that, you know, the Navajo government is trying to take over ownership of oil and gas leases, but not necessarily move away, even though those kinds of businesses might be controversial for some people there. But wouldn't that still mean that, you know, people out there are still subject to these boom and bust cycles that have been so problematic over the years?
Yeah, so it's not just the leases, it's like owning the whole company. So right now they are paid, you know, a small amount to by these companies for use of the land, and they've taken a small fraction of what is the profits. But President Russell-Picque was talking about, what if the nation owned the whole operation, and then it would be taking in exponentially more revenue. That's kind of his vision. I don't know that that's necessarily shared by everybody out there, and I'm sure Marley can speak more to whether there's any controversy or pushback around that issue.
What do you think, Marley?
Oh, there definitely is. Yes, there definitely is, because going back to what I said about a permanent homeland, if you live in an area and you're not going to move from that area, you want to protect your homeland. You want to keep it safe. You don't want it polluted. And people have realized and are very much aware of the pollution from the uranium. And so now they're asking questions. They're educated. They're coming in and uniting themselves as a community, and they're getting their tribal leadership to also speak out for them. And out in the eastern area where they're trying to run through a oil and gas pipeline, and fracking would begin around Chaco, the people are out there and they're protesting physically and also using the social media to get information out. So they're bringing in a lot more help And I guess in a way, as I'm talking about that, they're also creating some jobs for themselves because they're setting up these little community-based information centers where they're actually getting jobs set up for individuals in the community who want to go out and educate the people and also who want to go out and also do their own monitoring. There's a lot of activity as far as environmental programs here on in the small community. So that's a, you know, that's a way of a resiliency and also creating employment.
Well, I want to come back to this issue of the booms and busts, though, Marley, because I'm wondering what the Navajo government is doing to brace for if they're moving to take over oil and gas operations. Is there a plan in place to deal with the inevitable cycles of oil and gas prices? New Mexico's economy as a whole right now is really hurting because oil and gas are low. So is that something they're aware of? Is that something they're planning for? Or are they moving towards, you know, relying on something that could cause potential economic problems in the future?
Well, they are doing that. And with all the communities that are now feeling the pinch from the loss of the extractive industry, they are trying to replace that. And right now they're doing that with alternative energy. And over in the Arizona portion of the Navajo Nation is Navajo Generating Station. And the owners of the Navajo Generating Station said, well, we don't need it anymore. You know, it's a coal-fired generating station, almost 50 years old, and so we're going to shut it down because it can save money by using gas, oil and gas, to create power for ourselves. And so the Navajo Nation stepped in and they looked at the transmission lines and they said, we can use those transmission lines to start pushing out any power that we generate from alternative energy. And recently, Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, which is a which is owned by the Navajo Nation and is a utility company, provides water and electricity. They set up a huge solar farm out by Kianta near Monument Valley, and it is very successful. And so they are looking at trying to, which is, it, Kianta is close to where Navajo Generating Station is. And so they want to try to use to push the power that's being generated from that farm into the transmission lines, but also try to perhaps start using that old generating station when it's being reclaimed, after it's reclaimed properly, start using it also as a solar and wind plant. And so, you know, they'll be able to go that route and also replace some of the jobs. But there's still this discussion of some of these jobs are only temporary. So the small communities, though, are realizing that we need to do something for ourselves. And that's where Melissa came out, and she went out to the farming area, to the small community, and they're generating their own farm, and they're being able to make their own produce, and they're selling that. But they're also, the community itself is benefiting from it by eating the healthy foods. And also it's organic. And then you have the Navajo Nation, which is funding a program for organic meat. They're producing native beef, and it's being sold in the local restaurants here on the Navajo Nation.
That's interesting.
And they're slowly trying to expand it.
I know that Isleta Pueblo is working on a similar initiative for Native American beef. But, you know, Leah, this is a big theme of the project, right, that extractive energy has created a lot of instability for rural communities. Marley's talking about ways that the Navajo Nation is trying to buffer against this. But do you think that the oil and gas industry, the mining industry, all these things that do create booms and busts, couldn't you say that they've been a net positive? I mean, a lot of the cities that we have, a lot of these rural communities wouldn't even exist if it weren't for mines, if it weren't for oil and gas.
Yeah, it depends on how you look at it. I spent several years living and working as a journalist in Wyoming, which is a state that has benefited tremendously from the coal and other oil and natural gas industries. A lot of that state's infrastructure wouldn't exist if it weren't for the revenue that the state has received from this industry. There are something like 500,000 or 600,000 people in the entire state of Wyoming, you know. Right. And New Mexico's economy is a bit different, certainly more populous state. There's an income tax here. There isn't in Wyoming. So when we look at New Mexico in the context of all these other Western states, there are a lot of different narratives going on, and different states kind of take different perspectives on has the oil and gas or other extractive industries, you know, been a net positive or not. And it also varies community to community. You know, some communities in New Mexico are not at all tied individually to an extractive industry in their own community, but they benefit from, say, the taxes that the state uses in order to provide services to those communities. Yeah, it's I'm not taking a stand on either side of that question.
Sure, sure.
Because it's
and I guess it's
debated.
Not really necessarily a question of good or bad or black and white. I mean, this is looking from an economic perspective. This is just a question of here we are now, and this is what the future looks like, and what do small towns need to do to brace for that future. And on the line, we have another call coming from Heath Hassaman. Heath is a reporter at nmpolitics.net. Heath, thanks for calling in.
Absolutely.
You wrote a story for the Solutions Journalism Project looking at economic development and truth or consequences. What does the economy look like in that area?
Not good. TRC is in one of the poorest counties in the state. Obviously, the state's one of the poorest in the nation. Its median income is about $8,000 lower than the state's. Its poverty's high. More people are dying than are being born. Sierra County and TRC both have negative population growth. So the situation there is in some ways pretty dire.
And you reported on an interesting potential solution to this issue of the dire economy in beer, which is one of my favorite topics personally. But you reported on the emerging craft brewery scene and how that could be something that we could look at to stabilize small town economies, right? Why beer?
Well, TRC has a lot going for it in a tourism economy. Obviously, the lakes are there. They bring hundreds of thousands of visitors to TRC every year. That doesn't necessarily translate into tax revenue into the community. You know, a lot of people will go and camp there and they bring their food in. They're not spending a lot of money in the local economy. But there's also hot springs, and that's a pretty active scene with a lot of potential. There's a small but really vibrant arts community. But I live in Las Cruces, so an hour away, and I know a bunch of people here who in the past have said, I'll go to TRC for a day to soak in the hot springs, but there's nothing to do at night. Hmm. So why stay for the weekend? So this new brewery opened in downtown TRC in July, and it's bringing nightlife. It's filling that hole. You know, it's not a silver bullet. I don't think in TRC or in New Mexico there is a silver bullet for our economic problems, but it's an important piece in building a better tourism economy in TRC to give people an incentive to stay there overnight or for a weekend instead of just going up for a day. And they'll spend more money doing that. They'll stay at hotels. They'll soak more. TRC has some actually really incredible restaurants. But again, historically, for the last few years at least, everything in the town would close down at 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And now there's a brewery that's staying open later. There's some restaurants downtown that are staying open later because the brewery's there. So there's a lot more activity at night.
Even if we're not looking just at the question of how much money do these breweries bring in, but how much money, you know, combined with the fact that people are staying overnight, staying for the weekend, staying at hotels, spending their money in town. Still, is that really enough to make a difference in terms of the economic future of these small towns?
I think it's individual to each town. Breweries are certainly not a silver bullet for every town. I did, in my story, included some reporting on Paonia, which is a town in western Colorado, that really weathered the Great Recession in large part. I talked to their mayor at the time. He attributed much of that to the brewery, which, you know, as a mine was shutting down and jobs are being lost. This new brewery opened, and that helps create a critical mass that opens up opportunities for wineries and farmers markets and other things. And suddenly they're getting visitors from the big cities in Colorado coming out looking for a weekend experience and good beer and a rural quality of life experience. And he credited that brewery with allowing the town's government to keep its budget largely flat while the other governments in the area were having to cut budgets and lay off people. So it certainly can help.
I imagine, I mean, at some point, though, in terms of growth of businesses in these small, far-flung towns, you're going to run into the same infrastructure problems we were talking about earlier on the Navajo Nation. Like, say you're a brewer, how do you grow your business? How do you eventually get to the point where you can distribute your beer outside of your town when there's just not that kind of critical mass of economic development? Is that something that these towns are running into?
TRC benefits actually from having really good connectivity, both that they're on the interstate and then they have good broadband in the town. It's actually as good as Las Cruces is, given that it's, you know, 6,000 people versus 100,000 people. That's definitely something they have in their favor. The brewery opened, the owners of the brewery spent their savings on investing in this business, but they also had grants from USDA Rural Economic Development and from the state's LEDA funds. And that state grant of $125,000 requires them to create, I think, 8 manufacturing jobs within a few years. So that does put them on track to becoming more than just a drinking establishment and actually becoming a distributor. And they're already networking with other breweries in the state. I know that there's this whole culture in New Mexico of, you know, sharing your beers. And that's marketing too. You drink a beer in Albuquerque or Las Cruces, it's from TRC, and then there's people that want to go to TRC and experience that place and drink it again. So it can help. And again, you know, TRC, Sierra County is the place where we've built the spaceport, which may or may not ever bring the tourism to the region that people hoped for a decade ago. But we do have Virgin Galactic sounding increasingly optimistic, and they say they're fairly confident that they are going to start flying people into space next year from Sierra County. Ted Turner owns one of the hot springs lodges in TRC and 2 big ranches in Sierra County, and he's invested a lot of money there. There are these big outside investors also putting a lot of money into TRC. But even if Virgin Galactic happens, you know, if those spaceships start taking off and flying paying customers into space, if that happens, it's not just somebody flies in, goes into space, and flies out. They're here for several days at a time. They've got to go through medical testing, training. You know, these are high-dollar folks who are probably bringing families or friends or their entourage with them, and those people are going to need things to do during that several days. So,
right, so you can come back from outer space and have a beer. That's a trip that sounds fun to me. Well, you're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. We're broadcasting live from the University of New Mexico, and we're talking about how small towns in our state are faring in today's economy, potential solutions to rural New Mexico's job and economic challenges. Do you live outside of Albuquerque or Santa Fe, how is your community's economy doing? What do businesses need to thrive there? Where do you think the jobs of the future will come from? And where does rural New Mexico stand in that equation? Give us a call at 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. We'll be right back after a short break.
Santa Fe artist Sam Scott is a longtime supporter of KUNM. He wanted to do something special to keep us going in these challenging times. So he painted a $5,000 still life especially for KUNM. It's 20 by 16 inches and titled Bouquet for Grandma Regina Brave. She was the last person to leave Standing Rock. If your membership lapsed or is about to, watch your mail and send back the card before November 1st. Or see it, donate, and enter to win at KUNM.org.
When using Native American elements or themes in storytelling, there can be a fine line between telling a good, scary story and trampling on sensitive Native traditions. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk with Native horror creators and fans about what it takes to make Native horror work and when it goes too far.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico, a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth investigative coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. And right before the break, we were talking a little bit about some of the development initiatives in southern New Mexico and what that could mean for the future of the area. And Heath was mentioning the Virgin Galactic Commercial Space Center. And Leah, I know you were writing about issues in Dimming and some of the cross-border initiatives that were going on there and how that might help the economy in southern New Mexico. I wonder, what is it about the location of that part of our state that really stands to benefit in terms of the future of the economy?
Well, what I found in Dimming was, in one sense, a picture of what the rest of the country might look like in a generation. It's a community that has flipped demographically over the past generation. So 30, 40 years ago, it was two-thirds white and a third Hispanic and foreign-born people of color. Today, that is the exact opposite demographic makeup of Dimming and Luna County, in large part due to immigration over the years and a federal immigration initiative called the Bracero Program, which people in New Mexico are, I think, more familiar with than the rest of the nation. And this has changed the makeup of the community, and the community has wrestled with this changing demographic in a pretty productive way. Job growth, amazingly, in Luna County was among the highest in the state over the past 10 years or so. Those jobs have come a lot from construction and government jobs. And when we look over the past 40 years, manufacturing has made a huge economic boon in that community. It's home to the nation's largest chili processing plant in Luna County. And there's a lot of interesting stories from that community where immigrant labor came in and these immigrants made a name for themselves. They bought land, they planted their own roots in this community politically, economically, culturally, and they stayed, you know, until today when, you know, the mayor is Hispanic and one of the city council members is the son of a Mexican immigrant and lobbied hard over the years for improvements in his neighborhood where he grew up. Now a street is named after his family.
Right. And you found that researchers have concluded that this kind of diversity can really be an economic asset for a community.
Right. And the way that works, or the theory at least, is that places that are culturally rigid, that aren't open to new ideas, new ways of thinking about the world and ways of thinking about work specifically, don't adapt, they don't change, they don't grow, and they aren't open to new technologies or other ways of developing. And places that are culturally diverse just inherently aren't that way because they have a lot more openness and this sort of acceptance to new ideas. That's the theory anyway.
So you would think that if diversity was an asset, then we'd be doing really well in New Mexico.
Right. I mean, it's a real question. The kind of dark underside of the Bracero program is that there was a pretty controversial end to that program where the country tried to deport many of those people who had lived here now for almost 20 years, which was the length of the program in the 40s and 60s. And there's this real question for historians about whether wages were fair during that era. You know, immigrants from Mexico came in, filled this critical labor shortage during World War II, but were they paid fairly? There's a lot of historians that say no, they weren't. And so there's this sort of give and take between who benefits, you know, and how fair are the wages still today going on in that region.
I want to take a couple calls really quick. We have Mario on the line from Bernalillo. Mario, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi. What's your thought?
Well, I'm calling from, actually, I'm on 550 going towards Torreon, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tribal, really rural area. And what we are doing, the community, we are looking to leverage community libraries because the thing is a lot of Native communities don't have tribal libraries. I mean, Pueblos do, but have local community libraries and the ability to leverage federal monies to get in high-speed broadband into those communities. I mean, mobile is fine, but when you have a hardcore dedicated fiber optic connection, it allows you to do a lot of things. And so we're trying to create an incubator and a maker space in that little tribal library. And it's a very small community. And our community, there's three of our community that we're trying to work with. We are right next to the oil fields, oil and gas fields of Northwest New Mexico. And so a lot of the benefits of those 20,000 oil and gas wells have never even reached our communities. And so we're at the very cusp of what this whole discussion is about.
That's really
and
interesting.
And just to add in one more is that the Navajo Gallup, the San Juan River settlement, is bringing in like 10 times the amount of water a community has had in the past. And so the ideas of organic farming, organic, you know, intense organic farms is a reality. And we're trying to grow heirloom varietals so we can sell in the market and so and co-opt the whole program. And so,
and Mario, where
we're working on the ground level and just in, and it's all in the face of what's the world beyond oil and gas, and we're trying to get there. We're at the very spear point of getting this done.
And where's the plan on selling your vegetables, selling the stuff that you're creating in the community? I mean, is this something that's staying in the community, or are you looking farther into Colorado or into, you know, Albuquerque and Santa Fe?
Well, there is a market out there. A couple of people are developing the market of organic foods. And right now there's a $7 million market. We heard it. This guy came in, Arturo Sandoval. He says he has a market of 7 million, but he can, of all the co-ops he can source, he can only source $700,000 worth of vegetables. So right now the market for organic foods is very high, but he can only fill 10% of the order.
Well, thanks for
and
your
so
call, Mario.
Vast room for expansion.
I want to go to Monica now. Monica's calling from Santa Fe. And Monica, thanks for your call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I work a lot with ranchers through the Kuvira Coalition. And so in hearing this talk, I was thinking about how much we need to, in addition to bringing in new kinds of jobs and economic opportunities in rural areas, how much we also need to, like, start training the next generation of ranchers. Like, I think that ranchers and farmers, the average age in the country is 59 and it's rising. But one of the big issues we have is that we don't have a lot of young people who are trained to step into those roles. And then trying to also ensure that they have access to land that's affordable, especially when so many people have a lot of student debt if they've been to college. And then also once they do get started, making sure that, especially in the case of like cattle ranchers, that they have access to enough processors. I think we have pretty limited options for meat processing in the state. And given that beef is such a big part of our agricultural economy, I think we really need to build that up to enable people to stay in agricultural positions in some of our rural communities.
And where do you see, Monica, these potential ranching and farming jobs or ranching jobs and meat processing jobs taking place? I mean, are these going to be things that are, you know, benefiting the far rural parts of the state or maybe, I mean, there's plenty of ranch land just next to, you know, our cities here. So maybe this could be something that ends up being an urban issue instead of a rural one.
I think for sure there's a lot of opportunities for agriculture closer to the cities. I think with some of our ranches, they really require large amounts of land, and so the affordability comes into question. And so because of that, some of the more places where you can have enough land to raise a viable operation of cattle are in some of the more far-flung rural areas.
Well, Monica, thank you for your call. And I want to go up to the northern part of our state in Taos. We have Stacy Matlock on the line, and Stacy is editor of the Taos News. Hi, Stacy.
Good morning.
Stacy, you and another reporter there, John, have been looking at how Raton has been investing in economic development projects. And can you talk a little bit about what the problem they're trying to solve is up in Raton?
Yes, and John actually looked at Farmington, and I looked at Raton. This is my story this week, or next week, will be the second in a five-part series I'll do over 5 years. So the first story in Raton was last year as part of Solutions Journalism, and this is the second year that we're coming back to the town. So Raton is unusual in New Mexico in many ways because it is literally a town of immigrants. They have families from all over the world that immigrated to that little spot near the Colorado border in the 1800s to mine coal. And that coal was used for steel and then later to power the trains on the railroad track, and then later for power plants, but mostly for steel and the railroad. Their heyday was all through the 1900s until about 1990, and then those mines began to shutter, and by 2003, all those coal mines were shut down. And so Raton saw an exodus, both of jobs and people, and they have been struggling to recover ever since.
So what steps have they been taking to try and bounce back from the bust that came from the mining closures?
My understanding from talking to people in the town over the last 2 years, first thing they did was they had to get a new guard of officials in, a younger guard that was willing, as I think one of your prior callers said, to try new things and to look beyond mining and their other big economic driver had been horse racing for a while. And they had to try to figure out what could the town offer to bring in new businesses or support existing businesses. So one of the first things they did was go around and look at what do we have to offer. And actually, for a little town, it has a lot to offer. It has a lot of water, or at least a lot of water rights, unlike many places in the state. They have a major interstate going through the town. They are equidistant from Denver, Albuquerque, and Amarillo, almost exactly 200 miles from each of those cities. So it makes them a great stop-off point for travelers. They have a railroad track, and they have an airport with an extra long runway.
So they have,
and they have a high-speed internet almost all the way through town now. Not quite, but they're working to expand that. And they have, most importantly, cheap real estate because when everyone left, the price of real estate dropped. So they have a lot of beautiful old buildings. They have a lot of houses. And so they're trying to parlay all of those resources into attracting businesses.
What about tourism? Is that an issue that they're looking at? I mean, you're calling us from Taos, which is one of the tourist hubs of New Mexico, and I know that's one of the biggest drivers of the economy overall here. And I wonder what the approach is to that possibility in places like Raton and other small towns around the state.
Definitely. They're looking at tourism and, again, trying to draw people off the interstate into the town to spend some money, stay at their hotels and things. So that's a big one. So they have, for example, a brewery that was in the works last year. It's now opened, and it's a microbrewery, and they're hoping to bring both locals and visitors in. They have a gentleman who opened he builds custom hot rods, and they actually had a run to Raton this last year that drew in thousands of people, hundreds of old cars and hot rods and motorbikes. And so he's from Texas, but he's opened a custom shop there, and he already has a pretty big reputation. And you have somebody from Florida who she and her partner bought an old hotel, and they've turned it into the Raton Pass Inn, and they're catering to people who kind of like the renewed love of vinyl. This hotel is kind of retro, and they're attracting a lot of people who like this small town feel. But beyond tourism, Raton is doing also something interesting. They have a couple of things a lot of towns can't tap into. They have the Whittington, the NRA Whittington Center. And I know a lot of your listeners will be going, oh, no, guns. But in truth, you know, thousands and thousands of people come to that center, and it lies just a few miles from Raton.
Well, that's all the time we have, Stacey. I'm sorry to have to stop you there. I wish we could talk a lot longer about this. But if you missed part of this program or want to hear it again, you can find it and past episodes on our website, KUNM.org. We're also podcasting the show on iTunes. And you can see all of the stories on rural New Mexico's changing economy at High Country News. Just go to hcn.org. Thanks to our guests, KUNM reporter Marisa DeMarco, Leah Todd of the Solutions Journalism Network, reporter Marley Shabala, Heath Hausman of nmpolitics.net, and Stacey Matlock of Taos News. And thanks to the D-Numbers for our theme music. Marino Spencer engineered the program today. Victor Onimale answered the phone. Sarah Trujillo live-tweeted the show. And Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and the McCune Charitable Foundation. Find out more online at publichealthnm.org. I'm Ed Williams. Thanks for listening. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM.